Welcome to the Quality Time Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Woodworth, and this week we're joined by producer, director extraordinaire, former comedian from the Baltimore area, Mr. Brandon Lescure. He's joining us to talk about one of the fucking best little gems, I think, of 2019 in Midsummer. Boy, what a jam-packed episode. It is a two-parter, but listen, it was just too much for one whole ep. We're stringing it out into two, so there you have it. That's about it. Anyway, if you could be so kind, though, generous listeners, you love the show, drop us a five-star rating on the Apple Pods, the Stitcher, the Podbean, you know, whatever platform you do listen to us on. We love the ratings. It helps us out. And costs you absolutely nothing, but means the world to us. So, without further ado, get strapped in, turn that volume up to 11, and get ready for Midsommar.
Hello, kiddies. It's your old pal, the Crypt Keeper. This is a big shout out to my friends at Quality Time Podcast.
You know the Trump, he looks orange.
Got his ass again. Go off, King. Go off. Hey, I gotta be honest with you. My favorite thing is all the Cumtown people that support Tom Myers, so he thinks he has a huge fan base. It is the funniest thing. Like, everything he says.
It's made him like 100 times more popular than he ever should be.
Yeah.
Like, I know Agreed. People who listen to Cubtown who don't do stand-up and know nothing about stand-up and know nothing about Tom Myers. They've never met him, but they think that he's, like, a real comedian. And it's infuriating.
Mm-hmm.
what they've done to him.
Yeah, I love it just because every time he burns somebody, he shits on one of them. It's just, go off, King. You come at the king, you best not miss. Fucking, you mess with the bull, you get the horns. It kills me every time.
My favorite thing was watching him bomb at that mic the other night, which could happen to anybody. Like, I'm not that hateful, but the best part was that he's having this onstage meltdown about Joe, and I'm just watching himself implode. And I was like, oh man, like, this is fantastic. I can't believe he drove out here just to have this meltdown.
I've been watching Tom Myers bomb for way too much long of a percentage of my life at this point. I could have had a PhD by now, but I've been spending the last decade watching Tom Myers like nervous, like do his weird like nervous Asperger's tics in the back of a room for a fucking decade.
It's been a new installation. It's been a new installation in my life.
Yeah, okay,
cool. You look great and you look sexy too.
Well, yeah, I know that already. Thank you, though.
I'm masturbating while we're watching this. So.
Yeah, everybody else
I can see the shake. I can see the shake. Everyone noticed.
It takes me like a half hour to climax, though.
Yeah, that's fine.
And it also never gets hard.
Yeah, this show is called Midsommar Bust. So at the 30-minute mark of this episode, Jeremy will climax, and then we'll have to burn him in a bear suit. And that'll be the episode.
I've got one in my basement, so we're good.
I'm sorry, I didn't really watch all this movie. I watched it until they had like a dinner, and I'm pretty sure the movie is how she like comes to terms with being happy with her parents dying.
yes, that is good. Well, I don't know. Let's just jump right into it. Welcome to the Quality Time Podcast. I'm your host, Mr. Eric Woodworth. I'm joined by my brother, Mr. Jeremy P. Woodworth. Jeremy, how are you, sir?
Who are you talking about?
Okay. Who do we have on the show this evening?
It's me, Michael Winslow.
Oh my god. It's Michael Winslow again. Look at all those noises.
I'm going to be on every episode now. Just like an hour, like a whole hour.
Yes, please don't do that ever again. And then, of course, we have our other host, Miss the very lovely, very talented Miss Ashley Pontius. Ashley, how are you doing, love?
Hi, Daddy. I'm good. I'm a little gross and sweaty, which is why I am thankful not to be on the camera feed. I'm moving into a new apartment.
Well, congrats on that. Liberation.
You have a handful of butter in your hand right now.
A handful of
butter. Oh, my God. There is a whole story. I've been getting so many emails and phone calls. And, like, someone from my parents' church complained. Oh, my God. It's been a whole... No, it's part of why I'm moving out. There was a complaint, and my parents were like, we can't do this anymore.
Well, look, you blow one stick of butter on the internet, and now you're the pariah of the family. And...
You know, if Unitarians can't handle a good butter porn, then fuck them.
Yeah, they don't need you.
Look, Butterface is my magnum opus, and I'm ready just to put it out there for the world to see. Brandon, hit me up privately later. I will send you Butterface.
And that brings us to our special guest. Yeah, this is our special guest, the man who I haven't seen in ages, but I ran into him at the Magoobies Joke House a couple weeks ago. I'm sure he's going to tell us what he's been up to. Mr. Brandon Lescure. Brandon, how are you, sir?
Hey, man, I've never missed you saying my name. You say my name perfectly.
Is that right?
You do. I don't even know if you've ever asked how to pronounce my name, mm-hmm. but you say my name perfectly. I wish every host for every comedy show said my name because they usually butcher it. So I've always had a special place in my heart for your voice.
Thank you.
I missed you too. Thank you, Eric.
Yeah, so I guess how do we introduce you? You used to be the ringleader of Color Me Funny, which is a disbanded comedy group from, I guess, the Harford County, Maryland area. You, Mike Turpin. Times were rough, but you've all disbanded. But you've since gone on to do some horror shorts and stuff like that. Like, you're deep in the horror game now.
Well, I mean, I would say it's more than just horror, but yeah, I've produced, I hate doing stand-up. Stand-up is literally the worst art form possible. I know everyone on this show and a lot of people will probably listen to this show do stand-up. Just quit. Find something else. We're all here. Like, look, Kevin Hart doesn't want to do stand-up anymore. All right? There's a reason that Eddie Murphy quit stand-up. Like, we're all just finding means to the better end. And I have done stand-up for many, many years, and I finally realized that what I actually wanted to do was to make film. So the glory of Color Me Funny was that we got to do a lot of really bad sketch comedy videos, and since then I've kind of parlayed that into an actual career producing movies and commercials, and I'm fortunate. So yeah, I've done probably 7 horror films in the last 4 years, but I've also produced 15 other movies. Awesome. And television pilots and stuff. So yeah.
Well, that rocks, man. I mean, I'm happy for you. I'm it seems, is this filled the void of what you think your life path is and stuff like that? I mean, are you genuinely happy with what you're doing now? Or is it one of those things this is good for now and I won't put a bullet in my brain today?
Well, yeah, I mean, look, everyone's career is dead right now in the film industry because of COVID. So I want to kill myself every day. in fact, just yesterday I got on the phone with a director who wants me to produce a new short film, and he was just like, yeah, man, there's not a lot of money in this, but I figured this could be something good for you to kind of sink your teeth into. And I was just like, yeah, dude, this is just gives me like 3-4 more weeks to live, so that's good. Like, I, you know,
it's fun that even in the film industry that people still offer you spots for exposure only. That's pretty, I like that. That's the bar across the board, no matter what entertainment field you go into.
It really is. I mean, I'm fortunate enough that like my job in like film, we always get paid, but like actors, for sure, like actors don't get paid until they are like famous. Like no one gets paid for anything if I can help it, because the money needs to go to me, Eric. The money needs to go to me.
Yeah, you're like you're hauling equipment and probably, well, explain your job. Are you like the guy that goes out there and puts the little fucking track out there that the camera rides on so that they can actually do shots, or how does this all work? Take us through a Brandon Lescure production.
So that's the dolly grip. And I don't usually like to talk to those people because they're usually a little wacky. What I do is I hire the dolly grip and tell him when to show up drunk and when he can then leave and then go get drunk again.
They actually wear like old school train uniforms, like from the 1800s, right?
They do.
I mean, welcome. Show me where to put up the fucking dolly.
But no, I'm a film producer, so like I try my fucking best to stay away from any type of manual labor. Mostly, I'm dealing with like scheduling and permits and egos and fucking a sliding scale of moron. So yeah,
did you say permits?
Permit. Yeah, I did say permits.
You know, in real indie, you just have to know the time limit you have before you get kicked out of any place you're filming. So.
Oh hey, I'm with you too, man. That's the way it works sometimes on even like big productions.
Yeah, like the original Terminator was mostly shot all guerrilla style. James Cameron shot most of the first Terminator like that. No permits at all. Just go out in the middle of the night in LA and be like, yeah, we're going to go crash this car real quick over in this intersection. Come on, hurry up.
Yeah. No, I mean, you're totally right. And that's how it still is today for a lot of productions. Like, you know, unless it's a fucking Mission Impossible movie, you're cutting some corners somewhere along the way to get the movie done, whatever gets it done. I still do it quite a bit, and I just keep secrets to myself, and so that no one else knows that hey, what we're doing is actually illegal until we finish, and then I'll tell everyone, hey, by the way, we were not supposed to be here today. So police weren't called, so we're good.
That's the way I usually go with it. So like I do some contracting work for the dreaded Comcast cable company. But yeah, there's jobs where I should probably get a permit for, and then maybe I know who the inspector for the area is, and maybe I make sure that he's in a different spot while my crew is doing something, because I need him to check out something very important across town right now. And then the job is just magically already done. So yeah, shit like that happens. Yeah, all the time.
You know it, man. You can now be a film producer. You now have the skill set to just lie to people.
Yes.
Brandon, you're I haven't seen your horrors yet, but I'm assuming they got a lot of freaking comedy in them.
Yes. Yeah. I've done a bunch of, well, the ones that I write and direct are definitely horror comedy. That's kind of my voice. But I've produced a bunch of straight horror films. In fact, just recently, I was fortunate enough to produce a short film called Trapped, which was co-written by Stephen King. And that was really terrifying to be able to actually work with someone who is like an idol.
Yeah, I thought that was like the biopic of the band Trapped, like that guy.
Yeah, I wish. No, actually, that's next. It's that's next on my plate. No, Stephen King has the worst taste in cinema, and I got to see that firsthand because as we were editing the film, literally everything that I wanted to not be in the movie, the notes we were getting back from him were just like, keep that. That's the stuff I like. It's just like, he just can't not be bad at movies.
He was like, wait a minute. Are you telling me you're cutting out the Green Goblin truck that I insisted upon you building and making and putting in the film?
Right. Yeah. So in the movie, we had like this, it's a girl in a woods. She gets caught in a bear trap. Was the bear trap put there on purpose? Or was she just, was it just happenstance? So anyway, at a certain point, like this snake comes up to her. And the snake didn't work. Like, it looked terrible. We couldn't get a good snake. The snake actor was not great. I wanted to cut this thing. And the notes we're getting are just like, Steve likes the snake. You got to keep the snake. The snake's got to stay.
God.
So it's fucking in the movie. Like, every note that he gave us back are bad. It makes the movie worse. Yeah. The movie is good despite The movie is good despite Stephen King.
Oh, man.
Yeah. His movie, listen, the only way, I think after Stephen King dies, what will happen with his properties will be good things. Because does that make sense?
Yeah.
When he no longer has that influence over it, I think it's going to be better for the King brand. Because, listen, he's a great book writer, and he sets a table really good. He's great at, like, chapter one. Act one, it's all really good. And then most Stephen King novels outside of his like 10 greats are just fucking pure shit for the rest of them. It just makes no sense. There's all of a sudden God hands that show up. It just makes no sense at all. Mm-hmm. There's no payoff in most stories.
I'll tell you what no one's ever done. No one's ever done a movie about sloths killing people.
Yes.
But it's the worst chase scene of all because they're being chased by sloths.
Yeah, that's a Stephen King-esque thing right there.
Attack of the Killer Sloths.
Yeah. You know what I did like? I will say I enjoyed the new Dr. Sleep movie. I actually just watched it again recently.
I love that. Loved it. Beautiful. Loved it.
It's such a nice thing because obviously Stephen King historically he hated the Stanley Kubrick film, which most people love. If you like movies, then the original Shining is a fucking classic. You love it the way it's shot, but it's not like the book. And somehow they took the book Dr. Sleep and yet somehow paid a perfect homage to the original Shining, yet still kind of brought it into that Stephen King kind of larger universe world. And then they took you back to the Overlook Hotel, which is pretty exciting. I thought it was very, very well done.
I agree.
The Dr. Sleep is actually a terrible novel too. So like it's all 100% Mike Flanagan being a great director. Mike Flanagan, Towson educated, by the way.
Mm.
Yeah. Mike Flanagan, amazing filmmaker. It's 100% his like reason that movie's worth a shit, because all the good shit in Dr. Sleep did not come from the novel. Like, psychic vampires. How did he make that work? That sounds, just saying that, my dick shriveled up a little bit. Saying the word psychic vampire. It's a great film. I loved it. I cried.
I loved it.
And it was beautiful.
Ewan McGregor did a great job. But no, I like. Mm-hmm. I think you know, there's nerds like me who read the Stephen King universe, and the idea of like it kind of I always link it back to his giant saga, which they have fucking murdered in the film already. But the Dark Tower series, where everything is kind of connected into one big Stephen King universe, and I think Dr. Sleep kind of tied that back into that, when the original Shining, I don't know, necessarily kind of did that. But
I still don't understand how the little character Danny got into like erotic asphyxiation and got it on with like that naked old chick in the bathtub.
Yes.
It happened after he watched that guy in the bear costume blowing the other guy that really made a mark on him.
I will tell you, one time I took a trip to Las Vegas with Die Laughing Productions, and me and Justin Schlegel were sharing a room one day, and sitting in Las Vegas, we played this fun game with the other guys in the room to see how long Justin and I could watch grandpa porn until we were thoroughly grossed out. And I tapped out at about the 6 minute mark, and Justin held the bit for the whole half hour. He is a foul. It is like watching two of those monsters from the tub just go at it for 30 minutes. It is. That's
you know
real
what?
Terror.
That makes a lot of sense, though, as to why he was not as upset as I expected about the butter pictures. That explains a lot.
Man, Eric, that was playing with fire, my friend, because like you, I don't think you get to choose your kinks in life. How would you have known? What would you have done if you like were watching this grandma grandpa porn and all of a sudden like full like rock hard diamond erection? Like then you realize like this is what you like well, this is you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad that you know Mimi and Pap Pap are all dead in my life. So you know, I think the urge would be immediately removed. Furthermore, you know, listen, sometimes you find yourself when you're 37 years old sitting in a motel room in Las Vegas with a radio DJ. So I mean, I think that's just that's actually an allegory for life more than anything.
Isn't it more of the suspense to see which of them dies really? During having sex?
Oh my God, that's hilarious.
Really is. That should be the title of your memoir, by the way. Sometimes you find yourself at 37 years old in a hotel room in Las Vegas with a radio DJ.
And then the audio book just in the background, same as it ever was.
Well, anyway, let's. Is there anything else we need to bring up, guys? I'll throw it to my co-host before we get into tonight's movie.
Do we want to play a little excerpt of the song that I made for Rob Meyer?
Oh, is that what you sent on the Facebook chat, Jer?
No, I sent it to your phone.
Oh, you sent it to my phone?
On Messenger.
Yeah, in the Messenger, right? Isn't that the thing that you sent to Ashley and I? I could probably pull that up. Hold on.
You don't have to play the whole thing. It's 3 minutes.
Well, let's give a little taste. So this is a song. Do you want to preface this at all, Jeremy?
I made this for Rob Meyer, and he didn't even acknowledge me. So
Rob Meyer, the great Rob Meyer.
Rob Myers.
Rob Myers. So you made this for Rob Myers. Is there anything else? It's just a song for him.
Well, it's of course his main joke, which I think was also in a movie once, but. Either way, I'm just trying to get attention so I can get more, you know, attention for the show.
That's weird, Jeremy. You never do that. Okay, let's try this out. Here we go. You guys hearing that on your end?
Yeah.
All right, cool. Mm-hmm.
And then it cut out.
You might have made it with the entire basketball.
Very good, Jeremy. So listen, for anybody who wants to hear the song in its entirety, I will place it at the end of the episode after we sign off, and you can listen to it in its full glory.
Worst mixing ever.
Yeah, well, I mean, listen, I think you could back off on maybe up the vocals just a hair and maybe down the bass just a smidge.
Already.
And also maybe I would turn down the horrifying aspect of it. You know, the part where it just horrifies everyone.
I don't want to change Jeremy's brand.
I was just going to overlay the tracks of me growling and burping. So, yeah.
Oh, classic gosh. Jeremy. So,
that stays on while we fuck.
Not. turn it up. That is what if, all right, listen,
every girl I have sex with always says the same thing, is it in? So
hey, listen, you get wow. to you
I've been in for 5 minutes, what are you talking about? I'm done.
Okay, listen, you find the dream woman that, or man, you know, whatever you're into, right, that you get to have sex with, but the caveat is they only fuck while listening to Jeremy Woodworth originals. Do you do that or no? can you finish to just hearing Jeremy's horrifying music the entire
That's
time?
That's a good bet right there. See if don't say you need to dare Justin be like, can you actually finish while listening to this?
Most people end up vomiting.
I don't know, man. I want to find out just how depraved he really is.
Oh, man. So tonight we are going over the 2019, I'll call it instant classic, all right? Instant classic, Ari Aster's Midsommar, which is, his second film with A24, his first being, of course, Hereditary, which is in and of itself is a great film. This one was actually greenlit, I think, the week after Hereditary premiered. They greenlit Midsommar. So I don't know. This is this movie ultimately hits close to home for me because I have trouble watching it because this is my culture, my Norwegian Scandinavian brothers and sisters. I feel it doesn't paint them in the greatest of lights, but ultimately 100% accurate. We do all
say,
these things.
What are you talking about? Like light-skinned, blue-eyed people causing problems? What are you talking about?
No, it's I do love the fucking shit out of this movie. You know, I like how it is one of those films where what's the best way to describe it? It's one of those good for you, girl movies. You know what I mean? Like at the yeah. good for you.
Yeah, I liked it.
Eric, this has nothing to do with us because we're Norwegian and these are Swedes.
Yeah, okay. Whew.
Like, number one, you know, they have their different. They have their all pretty, pretty pagan sacrifice bullshit with flowers and everything. It's like, no, Norwegians, we put on the fucking horns and go out and kill people and go all the way to America to kill people.
Yeah, we weren't satisfied with just killing white people. We had to go across the globe and kill all peoples, you know?
Man, berserking, man. I mean, come on.
Fuck yeah, dude. Fuck yeah. But there is a... I love this movie. One thing... I mean, most of us have already seen it, but if... One thing I wanted to bring up is that this movie actually revolves around the number 9. Okay, the number 9 is kind of is very important. Some examples are just like the timelines of like what they call spring, spring, summer, fall, and winter, which are like the age cycles that the Harga talks about. Right, so it's like. Kids up to 18 years old, that's 9 times 2. And then they say that, you know, your summer is up to when you're 36, it's 9 times 4. Maturity, which is fall, 54, 9 times 6. And then, of course, winter, where you'll find out what happens to the end of them, is 9 times 8. So, and the festival of the big festival is every 90 years, again, 9 times 10. So there's just nines mm-hmm. everywhere in this movie. Good. All right. I'm glad.
It's also a 9-day festival, and 9 right. people are sacrificed. And mm-hmm. So
and
yeah, you're right.
And you listen to the Beatles' number 9 backwards. It's actually turned me on Dead Man. So
yes, I knew that. Now we got it, Jeremy.
No, I was just thinking, Eric, because you're like, oh, we're surrounded by nines, and I'm like, I unfortunately am not. I'm more like a solid Pennsylvania 7.
Oh yeah. But you know, if you watch really closely when this movie opens up, they show this mural that if you look at it and the careful viewer sees, it basically gives away the whole movie, like right in the first shot. The mural, if it goes left to right, it shows like Danny's parents dying over here. It then shows Pell kind of being the Pied Piper leading everybody to there. It shows, you know, the burning bear that we'll get to later, and all the people that are you're eventually going to die. Pretty interesting stuff. And it's one of those things that I guess Astor does in his movies where I realize if I ever talk to him, I feel like I wouldn't be smart enough to continue the conversation. You know what I mean? Like, you're like, oh yeah, this is how I tell you about the whole movie, but you're like, he would clearly realize, like, there's not a guy like Eric Woodworth who'll ever be able to figure this out. I can just literally give this to him and it won't matter.
I thought that the mural was just like an album cover from a Talking Heads album.
Yes, that's exactly what we were thinking, Jerry.
And also, I think the movie would have been a lot better if they just had the movie revolve around David Byrne from Talking Heads. And he just kind of goes nuts as more shit goes down. But he's actually not just any David Byrne. He's the guy from Letting the Days Go By Video with the glasses and the suit.
Why are you trying to tie this into the Talking Heads so hard?
No, hang on. He's got a good point. I'm a film producer here. I'm writing this down.
If we can get David Byrne into this, I think we can sell it to him.
I'm writing it
Midsummer.
Down.
Midsummer with David Byrne.
Yeah. What about Peter Gabriel? Anything with Peter Gabriel?
Oh,
I feel like his schedule
man.
Is probably more open.
Unless he wears like the flower head thing like he did from the 70s, then it might be okay.
Yeah. See, now I'm interested in...
How about this? Peter Gabriel in The Shocker 2, Shock the Monkey. Okay? That's...
See, now I'm interested to know if Brandon would direct my porno Midsummer's Eve.
If there's a pay
it's
involved,
9 days
I'll direct
of douching.
Anything. Oh, I like it. That's good.
Thank you. You have to. You know, you've got 28 days in a cycle. Got to wrap that shit up. You know what I mean?
Sandra Bullock's 28 days of douching.
Oh man, we are a Sandra Bullock's pussy podcast, just so you guys know.
I love her.
If you add zombies, it's 28 days later of douching. So.
Yes. Oh shit, that's so funny.
So we get to meet Danny, our protagonist, and Christian, her boyfriend. Their relationship is on the rocks. She seems like she's kind of needy. Christian wants to leave her, kind of, pretty much. And she feels
kinda
like she's
needy.
Yeah. All right, listen. I get it. Like her,
kinda.
His friends Look. Aren't wrong about how much she calls and how much she's crying. Like, I get it. If you're a young 20-year-old, she seems like a lot of emotional baggage, right?
Yeah.
Wow.
She was tough. Look, I'm gonna say it. All right. She also not a good girlfriend. All right.
What?
Christian sucks. He sucks a lot. He's a terrible, terrible boyfriend. But even before her parents died, he didn't want to be with her because she was overwhelming and she used him as her only sense of support system. And then her parents died and now he was like guilted into being like the rock. And I knew that was going to happen. I'm really glad that there's a female voice on this show and it's not just going to be me.
Well, I do
trying
I,
to stand barely. Up for Christian a little bit.
I do think in the first act that it's almost viewed as Christian is not necessarily a bad guy, but over the course mm-hmm. of the movie, you know, you watch it and he's clearly a piece of shit, right? The other decisions that he makes.
By the end, I'm not gonna mince words. By the end, yeah, everyone knows that Christian deserves to be in the bear suit.
Here's what's funny. I feel a little bit, and now that I've watched it a second time, I feel like my opinion has flipped a bit. I actually look at it in the beginning of him being the bigger asshole, and here's why, is because he acts like it's such a burden to be there for her when there's a serious problem in her family, and he absolutely could leave. He doesn't have to feel guilted into it. He does it because he feels bad. And when she is honest and open about her feelings, he immediately starts whining because he doesn't want to have the conversation. So I think he's a little shit at the beginning of the movie. At the end of the movie, I feel a little bit bad for him because he can't help that he's under a hair pie spell.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. I mean, you know, how many, everybody, you know, when you take hallucinogenic mushrooms and a little pubic hair wants to fuck kids. I get it. Like, we've all been there.
It has to be powerful because I've never had a man munch on my carpet and been like, I'm in love with you. I want to stay.
But obviously, in that first, at the beginning of this movie, tragedy does strike as Danny's sister commits suicide in quite epically graphic quite epic fashion by not just killing herself by extending a hose from the car exhaust into her parents into her own mouth like a gas mask, but also feeds another tube into her parents' room that she duct tapes under the door and just also basically suffocates them as well. And
I'm a little bit mad she stole my idea is all I'm saying.
And I think this is one thing about Ari Aster that he does. Like, he's very good at setting a atmosphere in his movies, right? The atmosphere is so good in this opening scene where there's not a lot of like big jump scares, just like in Hereditary, but there is always one moment where you watch the movie and that thing is just ingrained into your mind. Like, you don't forget seeing that shit with the hose duct taped to her mouth in the same way that you don't forget that chick's head getting folded back in Hereditary by the telephone pole. And it's just
a scene.
Quick thing that happens and you can't unsee it after that.
Agreed.
The one thing I hated about the movie, it's so quiet, but then the music comes in and I got my Bose speakers and was literally like vibrating the entire room. So I have to like turn down the volume, and then when it goes back to them whispering, talking like, yeah, what do you think about our relationship? Like, I was like, God damn it. Fucking movie bullshit.
Yeah, this movie is definitely sound designed more to be watched in a theater and not at home. I will say that. Like, I almost wish that sometimes, like, movies would remix their films when it comes to home theaters or televisions. Because I watched this in the movie theater, and I was not annoyed at all with that. But I've watched it at home and a couple times, and yeah, you're right. I'm constantly playing, like up and down on the volume of my speakers at home too.
It's like very explosions. Very... Explosions in Iron Man weren't as loud.
Yeah.
So
yeah, his scores are very interesting. Oh, sorry, Eric. Yeah, his scores are very interesting because yeah, you'll go, like you said, you'll go from like a very sullen, quiet, very intense conversation to like, you know, a string rip just right through the just right out of nowhere, and you're like, oh god, this is torture.
And I think I don't know much about Ari Aster except for, you know, seeing his two films. I would say that his movie making style is that of Stanley Kubrick. He uses a lot of the same things, especially like when moving from scene to scene. He does a lot of that same dissolve like transition, and then does those like traveling scenes in those same bizarre overhead shots where you also come in, except he does, you know, he adds his own artistic twist where he'll like flip it upside down as they're traveling and stuff like that. Very much I think he's in the same way Quentin Tarantino is a huge De Palma fan. So if you watch Brian De Palma films, you see Quentin Tarantino really just copying his filmmaking style. I feel like Ari does that with Stanley Kubrick.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk about Dorky Kid?
Yes.
You know, Dorky Kid.
I have a name, actually. You know that, right?
Brandon, you're at least 25 years old. What are you talking about? You're not a kid anymore.
You're a dorky man.
Thank you.
No, but seriously, you know, the dorky kid who had the perfect casting in We Are the Millers.
Oh, Mark in this movie, I believe.
Yeah.
You know, he's doing things like The Revenant and this film, and you're like, how the fuck did he make the jump from The Millers to these fucking unbelievably serious films?
Will Poulter. I actually love him in, if you guys haven't seen the Black Mirror movie.
Yeah, he's great in that.
He is
Bandersnatch.
Bandersnatch. He's fucking great in Bandersnatch. Also, another movie where he does copious amounts of hallucinogenic drugs. So I really like when he does drugs on film. It's probably my, I think that's his best work he does.
Did you know he was also, he was almost Pennywise?
Oh, really? I think he would have been a great Pennywise. Although
he does have those cheekbones,
Although
it was down to him and Skarsgård. So yeah, that and then he didn't get it.
I will say Skarsgård is a more scary person just because he's a weird 7 foot tall Swedish man, which I think is just terrifying in general. Like
part of the Skarsgård family, they're all terrifying.
They are. There's not one. I don't know. Listen, the one is pretty handsome. I don't know, the good looking Skarsgård who's like from True Blood, but the other two are monsters.
Well,
like,
their dad is Dylan, and he's a terrifying dude.
Yes, he looks like the guy that would cut you, but explain to you each incision that he's making into your body.
Well, he was fantastic as the villain in Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. He was absolutely so creepy in that. But you know, it's funny. You said your favorite work was when this kid is on drugs. But it's funny because in We're the Millers, he's not on drugs, but he's selling drugs. Hey, full circle.
Yes. So,
circling back to what you were saying about Ari Aster. So, yeah, he did kind of come from nowhere. Like, this guy, like, basically graduated from the American Film Institute out in LA and just kind of became a wonder kid, like just, you know, hit it out of the park with that first movie and hit it out of the park with the second movie. You could tell that he's pulling from Kubrick. He's pulling from people. Like, I think that his best characteristic right now is as a writer and not necessarily as a director per se, because I do think that he's pulling from other stuff, which is great. He's pulling from great shit, but I think it's his stories that are really setting him apart. Like, there's a lot of movies that look beautiful, like the way he shoots a movie, who are also stealing from Stanley Kubrick. But I think it's his story. I think that's the two things that he's doing better than anybody else. Like, I think these movies, his two films, they keep getting lumped in with things like The Witch and keep getting lumped in with things like It Follows. These two films are fucking 100 times better than those movies, mm-hmm. in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I think it has a lot to do with just this kind of around like the 2015 era. We got kind of a rebirth in horror where it like we're not in like slasher. We're kind of away from zombie right now, and now we've kind of moved back to this like 1970s kind of cerebral horror movies that are coming back into vogue. And there's three fucking honestly great directors. I can't remember the guy who did The Witch and all those movies, but him, Panos, who
David Eggers.
Yeah, so David Eggers, who did The Lighthouse and a couple other films, and they're out. So he's emerged as one of those. That we also have. I really love Panos Cosmatos. I mean, I fucking suck his dick on this show so much. Between
Mandy is a great film. Dude. I've never done hallucinogenics, but I felt like I did.
Yes,
when I watched Mandy.
Yeah. So between him and now you have also Ari Aster. They're kind of like. I mean. You're not going to not compare those guys because they're all working in the same era and at the springtime of their thing. Oh, who's that?
I've got a fourth I think we're missing out on. Is it James Wan? Am I getting that right?
Yes.
Yeah, because I mean, I feel like he may be even more so, at least for the public sphere of like popularized films. I mean, he gave us Insidious and The Conjuring, which I know, you know, they've gotten their own sequels and spinoffs, and I know that they're like less than. But I mean, really, as far as publicly loved big horror in this generation, I think he's also another one that kind of has to be noticed for really helping revive good dark horror.
Oh my god, you just like hit on a tangent that I can go off on for hours. I love James Wan. James Wan is one of my favorite filmmakers right now. Mm-hmm. I think he also reinvented the modern like box office horror twice.
Right.
Yeah,
because he did it with Saw.
He
accidentally invented torture porn, basically backed away from it and said, I'm just going to keep collecting the paychecks as the executive producer. I'll go do something else. Mm-hmm. Bombed with two other movies. came back with Insidious for $800,000. It made $100 million worldwide. He basically reignited the paranormal like Haunted House film, and made those things, you know, explode in the box office. Like, you're right. Like Ari Aster and David Eggers, like those guys, they're not making $100 million. And maybe they're better filmmakers, quote unquote. But right. James Wan blows up at the box office every single time, and I wouldn't trust. No one's trusting Ari Aster with like a $200 million movie. But James Wan has done Aquaman and Fast and the Furious now, so like obviously he's doing something right. So like, yeah, I could talk about James Wan forever.
I love that you feel that way. Yeah, just one more thing. Because, yeah, I think it's interesting that we got away from a lot of that camp, because Eric and Jeremy and I do love to talk about those campy horror movies because they're fun and, you know, the humor is there and it's a little more relaxed. But I love, like, a dark horror movie. I love that.
Can I just say that I think this director is really fighting harder than any other director and really showing more than any other director, because he's getting over the fact his name is Astor.
Thank you, Jeremy. Oh, thank you. Yeah. Well, I we will go back over this movie thing, but the one thing I wanted to say while you look at James Wan, you know, you look at him, he's, you know, if you go all the way back to Saw, what is that, like 2000 2001, something like
early
that,
early 2000s, right? Yeah,
so James, he's been
Wan
around,
is like a guy I look up to, because he broke into Hollywood knowing nothing. He had no money. Him and Lee Winnell, they had no money. They put all their money into a proof of concept for Saw, and like just put all their marbles in that they self-funded. They build the fucking head contraption themselves. They throw everything they got into it, and they get $1 million from Lionsgate when no one else would give them any money. And now it's 15 plus years later, and they're both two of the best filmmakers in the horror genre right now. And it's because they invested in themselves. That's something that, like, I can talk about those guys forever as like a jumping off point for people who want to jump into filmmaking. It's like, those two guys did not live in Hollywood. They did not know anyone. They lived in Australia. They did not have a lot of money. They had a great idea. They put all their money and all their effort into the proof of concept, and they made something good, and now they have great careers out of it. That's how you do it.
Yeah.
When you don't have money.
I think it almost parallels the story, not necessarily in the horror world, but to a Matt Stone and Trey Parker, very kind of similar story. Guys who were basically outsiders. They were music guys that went in and got a deal from Troma to make one movie, and then sold the rights to get a show called South Park that was made out of fucking construction paper on Cartoon Network, and now they have, you know, multiple movies, you know, Team America, the South Park movie, a show in South Park that's run for over 20 years. I mean, it's other than The Simpsons, it's the longest running show, right? For an adult based kind of comedy thing. So, but the other point I wanted to make earlier is the thing that makes me excited by seeing these kind of three directors really just taking off right now is that eventually one of them is going to get that $200 million budget to go do something. Because, like, just think about how, like, Sam Raimi started with, like, Evil Dead 1, Evil Dead 2. These were low-budget films. And then, you know, by the 2000s, this motherfucker is making Spider-Man for Sony, right? Like, and by the way, one of the Spider-Man 2, still probably the greatest Marvel movie ever made. I will die on that hill to this day.
It amazes me that he hooked up with the Coen brothers and made one of the worst films of all time with Crime Wave. But I love Crime Wave, so.
Listen, I do like Crime Wave too. So anyway, listen. So Danny's sister dies. Christian and his friends, they decide to follow Pell to go to the Midsummer Festival in Sweden, and which is like a secluded little area of Sweden that Christian is from to go to this 9-day festival. Now, Danny
isn't even spell summer right.
Yeah. But she ultimately.
I'm slowly starting to learn how the dynamics of this show works. By the way,
yes, Jeremy derails. We have. I sometimes make jokes. Jeremy derails, and that's how the show works, pretty much.
I like
and
it. I like
somewhere
it.
In the middle.
Sweets are stupid.
So, but Danny, this is listen. I'll say this. Danny should have never gone on this trip, right? Like, I get that Christian was a dick for not telling her about it, but like, she kind of invited herself on this trip. No, how do you see it?
I don't know, Brandon, you go first.
No, Ashley, defend your sex.
I just didn't. He's our guest. I think you're right to some degree. I do think she kind of invited herself. But here's the problem, though. I think the problem with Christian's a coward. So instead of just telling her how he feels and what he wants, he's too afraid to be honest with her and half-heartedly invites her and then is a coward when he tells his friends. He is the problem.
Yeah.
He is a coward. He definitely is a coward. I think, honestly, the problem does lie with both of them, though. Neither of them are communicating well.
Exactly.
She put herself in a position where she's so codependent on him that he physically, I don't think he could go on this trip without her, because she wouldn't, fuck him dying at the Harga. She would have died if she didn't go to the Harga, because she probably would have killed herself being alone for a month and a half.
Right.
Like, and that's where they're at. She's so codependent on him that she had to kind of invite herself on for self survival, you know.
Right.
So they make their trip to go to the Harga and immediately do mushrooms the second they get there, which is honestly, that's a good trip. And I will say, while I've said this before, that Mandy is a great depiction of what it's like to be on hallucinogens. This entire movie, every time there's a hallucinogenic scene, this is exactly what, if you've never done mushrooms, this is what it's like, in all honesty. Like, it's not like, it kind of comes over you in waves, and then it's subtle things, like looking down at your feet and seeing grass grow out of it. And you're like, I know that's not real, but that's pretty tight. Oh, cool, the tree's breathing. And then you just kind of sit there and go, ooh, here comes another fucking wave. All right, this is way too much, way too much. And then you kind of calm down for a second. It's probably the most accurate depiction of what it's like being on mushrooms that I've ever seen on film.
They said on the IMDb that he made it on purpose so that there's no subtitles when they speak Swedish. And I'm wondering if anybody who does know Swedish like sees those scenes and like he comes up, hey, these are the guys we're gonna kill later, right? You
know? Yeah, I wonder. I tried to look through some of the to see if there was any translations anybody had transcribed that, but I hadn't seen it. I did find out though that when this movie debuted in Sweden, while we think this is a horrifying kind of psychological thriller, they look at this as probably they actually considered it a dark comedy and thought it was hilarious. So they love it for a completely different reason. They're like, oh yeah, we are totally like that. Absolutely.
Their version of Dumb and Dumber.
Yeah, so. 100%. 100%.
Cool. You know they're going to get sacrificed, but they're too stupid to realize they see murals and everything.
Did they just not hear Harger just say they were going to make him a blood eagle in the first minute, or what?
and that's how the rest of the world views Americans, right there. It's just an indictment.
So we also get to briefly see Danny's tripping, though. She gets up because she's having a bad trip and then heads over to this shack, and very briefly you get to see the sister in the mirror just for a second. I never caught that the first time, but the second time I totally caught it. It's her with their full fucking mask on, just like, oh hey, what's up, sis? Which is I thought it was pretty wild.
Scary. Yeah, I liked that.
So Pell also kind of tells them about the life cycle as they all kind of settle into their surroundings, and they sleep in like this giant room with like babies and the rest of the town, and there's so much fucking cock drawings in this place. I don't know if it's a place that children should see ever.
It definitely made me rethink having children, because just hearing that kid scream, like at every point you can see her waking up in the night and the kid is still screaming, and I'm like, you know what, I think I'll just get my uterus removed. This is
awful. I'm so glad that Epstein didn't see this movie.
Yes. Oh, yes. I also do like that the cartoons, listen, you know, in our world of giant cock America, I like that these are realistically drawn cartoon penises, not setting an expectation of Swedish men that we can't live up to, you know? Like,
can we also talk about the creepy, like, long hugs that everybody likes to give each other, where they keep looking deep into each other's eyes and giving these, like, 20-second long hugs? I was like,
yeah, that is weird.
Whenever I hug a Woodworth.
And you can also...
Exactly. it's funny you brought that up, because I actually, this is, when watching it this morning, I noticed something where when they arrive at, like, the main camp, and I think Pell's, like, father or whoever, like, the older guy is, he shakes all the men's hands, and he says, welcome. And then he hugs Danny and says, welcome home.
Yeah, yeah. And that's...
And I, as the first time I noticed that, like, he doesn't say welcome home to anyone else. It's not, like, thrown in your face like a lot of movies would do, because obviously I would have noticed it by now if it was. But, yeah, he shakes every guy's hand and just welcomes them, but he says welcome home to her.
Interesting.
Sanitarium. Yeah, I think that's part of, you know, her, they kind of know that she's going to eventually be the May Queen, right? They know that she's part of the community. And you can see how Danny's just treated a little bit differently than everybody else there, right? From like the activities that she gets to participate in, to the fact that, you know, Pell, you know, in this same kind of part of the story, actually draws her a picture for her birthday and gives it to her, you know, basically making Christian also look like a piece of shit for forgetting her birthday. And then, you know, it's a lot of things where they immediately kind of say, no, you're a part of our family right away. You know, we want you to feel more comfortable. And nobody else kind of gets that same kind of treatment at all.
It's actually just a sprinkling for the May Queen. And, you know, this movie really points out that there are only two paths that you can go by, and there's always another chance to change the path you're on. So,
that's a really good point. And it does start to make you wonder, not to jump ahead too much, but you do start to wonder how much Pele actually had an influence into whether or not we come, because we talk about her inviting herself, but how much of that could have actually been influenced by anything Pele may have said or done. You know, to try and influence her to come on the trip. Well, because remember, he even talks to her at the apartment, though, at one point before they get on the plane.
And I think knowing that she is going to be the May Queen, because when you look at that, there's 9 sacrifices, and 4 of them are from the community, essentially, and possibly a 5th that, you know, Danny gets to decide ultimately. It seemed like that was always the plan, that she was going to be that person, right? If they could lead it in the right direction, she was going to be that person, and that was their plan. Otherwise, she just would have been the extra one that dies at the end, right? And somebody else probably would have been May Queen. But anyway, we'll get to that soon enough. So, you know, they go through this a bunch of shit. You know, at one time, Christian gives her a fucking piece of cake and then tries to light this candle, just kind of, you know, showcasing how their fucking relationship is horrible because he can't even get the thing lit. And they finally get to the big ritual day, which is, God, what the other big shock of the movie is probably this scene where they all sit down and the two elders are at the top of the table. They whisk them off to a rocky cliff as all of the congregation below, sans Mark, he decides to just take a nap and miss the coolest part of the movie. And they're sitting there as these two elders who have reached the age of 72 jump to their deaths in front of everyone. The first one smacking her face real hard, and which is pretty fucking brutal looking. But it's the second guy who really gets it. It's the older gentleman who just mangles his leg, and then you're like, oh, I wonder why this guy with a giant hammer is here. Oh, it's because it's time to go fucking play whack-a-mole with this old dude's face.
It's hammer time.
Yes.
Why did he jump that way? Like, did he not know how these things work? Has he not seen other people?
Yes.
Like, why did he fucking jump leg first? like off the cliff, like he was like landing into a, like a swimming pool.
Yeah, you don't pencil dive the suicide jump, right? Like, you swan that bitch and then make sure it ends quickly. Now,
And he missed the landing rock.
Yeah. Right. Well, you know that they all were probably thinking, oh, thank God this one is jumping. Like, we're getting rid of this guy because he has absolutely nothing to help the community. He's an
idiot. Yeah, he's 72 years of this asshole, finally. Get rid of them.
Now,
you know, the worst were the people in the front that actually held up scores on how well they jumped. You know, like the woman got like tens, but he got like fours and threes.
Deserved. He doesn't deserve to get the bronze. You know, he needs to.
So, I do. Now, this actually is derived from a bit of Norse mythology, where they basically they do you know. They would send elders out to a cliff to off themselves for the better of the community because they can't really work anymore. And now, historians, though, have seen that this was actually something that Norwegians would say about Swedish people as like a racist thing, because they were like, so Norwegians were like, they became Christianized before the Swedes did. And they would be basically, they would say, oh, yeah, the Swedes, they just fucking kill themselves by throwing them off at 72. We're good Christians. We don't do that. So it's actually just really a Norwegian racist fucking thing that they say about them, which is fun.
I like how you're trying to make some sort of like difference, but in the races between the most purebred, like white,
yeah,
like blue, like no.
Hey, listen, no racism was hard back then because, listen, this was before you have to understand, they had to be back then. Racism was just like, you worship the wrong god, right? It took another 500 years till we found somebody that you could immediately look at and be like, ah, I don't like that guy, he looks different, right? So yeah.
Right,
that's
you aren't wrong. It's like, we don't associate with them. Yeah. Why
the hell are you talking
they have
about
uncut penises?
What are you talking about? Yeah. Swedes are blonde and Norwegians are black haired. It's totally different.
Yeah, totally different. Totally different.
God, it must have been so hard to be a bigot back in the day.
It was really difficult. It was really difficult.
Plus, they actually go out and sunbathe every once in a while. So.
And that brings us to an end of Midsommar. Part one. You'll have to tune in next week to get part two. You can catch all things Ashley Pontius at Ashley Pontius Laughs on Instagram and Twitter. Go ahead, throw her a follow. She's got a bunch of shows coming up. Check her out. You can always catch everything Eric Comedy at ericcomedy.com. That's Eric with a K, comedy with a C. The second Saturday Shit Show is free every second Saturday of the month, live from the Auto Bar, hosted by Mike Quinlan and former co-host Kimberly Callahan. Jeremy, take us out of here.
It's me, I'm really Jeremy.
You might have made it with the entire basketball team. It might look like the Grand Canyon. Horse, but there's a choice.
Yes, there's a choice. If you go out, you stay tight.